Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and this is part of our Ornette Coleman Memorial Archive. We are talking with lots of people who knew Ornette, worked with Ornette, and had experience with him firsthand, and our goal is to, over the coming months and even years, accumulate as many of these oral histories as possible. And today, we're talking with Sylvie Jensen. Welcome, Sylvie.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Sure, thanks for doing this. And Sylvie, would we describe you as an opera singer?
Yes, you could definitely describe me that. Describe me as that at this moment. Although I've done a lot of different kinds of music, and definitely when I met Ornette, I was doing a kind of wide variety of different kinds of music. But yeah, now I sing with the San Francisco Opera and the San Francisco Symphony. And but at the time I was living when I worked with him, I was living in New York, and I did a lot of different kinds of stuff. But I like church music, jazz, avant-garde music, opera, musical theater, basically anything that anyone wanted to pay me to sing, I would sing.
Okay. And you're are you originally from the West Coast?
So yeah, I grew up in California, and I moved to New York to go to Columbia, and I went to university, and I met Ornette through my stepfather, who had started a music festival in San Francisco with Charles Amerkanian. It's called Other Minds, and it's still going now, 2015. I think it's at least 20 years old now. And Ornette had been involved in this festival, which is a festival of living composers and avant-garde music. And so yeah, there was, I guess it, so my stepfather was Jim Newman, and he had like a long history of being kind of a patron of the arts and working with a lot of interesting visual artists and musicians. He had produced a movie called Space is the Place, which was
really?
Sun Ra's movie. Yeah,
it's amazing. I know that movie.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen it? I'm sure you have.
Oh yeah. No, it's a great movie. It's awesome.
Everybody
yeah.
should see that. That is definitely one of a kind.
Totally.
They never made another movie like it.
Yeah. So he was definitely involved in kind of like the avant-garde art scene, and like I never got to meet Sun Ra, but there were a lot of musicians hanging around my adolescence. And then so when I was living in New York, then I got to meet Ornette, and we kind of hit it off, just meaning like, I don't know, we had an instant rapport. I think we went to lunch, and I was going through this period where I would eat a lot with my hands, and Ornette was like, oh, you're eating with your hands. It was like kind of a fancy restaurant. And I was like, yeah, I don't know, I always prefer it. He's like, yeah, me too. That's the way to go, man. So that was it. We were like communing over that. And then I guess after that, he was like, yeah, let's get together and make some music. And so I went to his apartment, which was on like 33rd Street. He had this this huge, you know, really beautiful loft at the time. But he told me like, oh, you know, this is like a really nice apartment that I have, but oh, I've lived in so many different places in New York. He said it used to be that everyone would move May 1st, and every year I just moved to a different place because I had no money or like, you know, got kicked out of places. And he told me also that he was mugged, you know, several times. I think there was one time that it was really bad. He was like maybe hit with a hammer or something like that. And,
he had a loft on Prince Street in the 70s,
right,
and somehow lost it and ended up all kinds of places, but one of the places he ended up was on a loft on the Bowery when the Bowery really was the Bowery.
Yeah, when it was rough.
Yeah, it was unheated, and he had a pot-belly stove, and he then, actually with my help, bought a public school building at the very end of Rivington Street. Which
right,
is now,
I remember him telling me about that too, yeah.
Yeah, and sadly, that is where he was attacked, in that building. In fact, there were two separate incidents like that. So, yeah, he definitely had a rough time. Now, the place where you met him, he had that loft for quite a while, years and years. So that was his final home, and he definitely had a good long stay there.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I know, that's where he was until the end. So he had finally found a permanent, comfortable base in Manhattan, which was his dream. I remember when he and I were talking in 1980, he said, "Oh, I want to buy a building in Manhattan." I said, "Oh, man, Ornette, that's going to be so expensive. You know, why don't we go to Brooklyn?" Or he goes, "Oh, forget it. No, it's got to be New York or nothing." You know, he was very fixed on that, which makes a lot of sense, really, in retrospect.
Right.
So how old were you when you met him?
I think it was 2001, so I was probably like 24 or something, maybe.
Okay, so you're out of school and you were working and finding your way as a musician.
Yeah, and so I was singing. I remember when I met him, I was really into Wagner. So I had been doing these like Wagner at Manus. There was a teacher who had like a Wagner program, and so these a lot of singers with bigger voices, they were coming together, and we did a few productions of opera. So, I mean, we got a whole orchestra together and it's like, a 100-piece orchestra. And, I mean, Wagner's music is actually like very chromatic and very kind of harmonically advanced for the time that he was writing. And so when I met Ornette, he told me a bit about his harmonics, and I guess he didn't explain it too much. He was just like, basically, nothing ever totally resolves. It's like you're always going from one harmonic structure, from one chord structure to another, and it's like leading from one place to another place and never going back to where you came from.
And in typical music or typical Western music, this idea of resolving, I guess the technical term is going back to the tonic. You go off somewhere and then you come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to my very simplistic understanding of Ornette's music was you went off and you didn't come back. Well, or you did come back, but not necessarily in
the way you started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thus the idea of freedom. This is important probably. A lot of people think, oh, well, free jazz, you just make any noise that comes to your head. I mean, it's not free in that sense, I think, but it was free in the sense of being liberated from, typical harmonic structure, I guess.
Yeah. And, it's interesting because I had been living, or I was living at that time in this building, which we called the Hint House. So it was on 131st Street and 12th Avenue, not too far from Columbia. And I lived there with some former students or like friends that I had met at Columbia, but there was a whole group of guys who had this band called the No Neck Blues Band there. And so they were kind of a free jazz band. And I don't know if I ever performed with No Neck, but I performed with some of the guys who were in that band in like other combinations or formations. And it was definitely experimental music and kind of like performance art. And it was fun doing that, but I always felt like with those kind of situations, I was missing some kind of like musical grounding or something. I felt like a lot of the people who were in the performance art and experimental art scenes were not musically trained, or they were not necessarily musicians. They wanted to be artists. They wanted to be doing something experimental and different, but they didn't necessarily have like musical skill or talent.
Mm-hmm.
But so then when I met Ornette and started playing with him, I thought it was just, it was pretty great because he was so experienced and he was so musically astute. And, but I think like we really liked working with each other because, so I was, it's like we improvised together. I went over to his studio on 125th Street, right near the Metro North train and so
yep.
Park Avenue. And so I played, so this was in advance. I guess we had gotten together and he said, well, why don't you come to London? We're doing this concert and we're involving a bunch of different kinds of musicians and like, why don't you come over and play with us and see how it would feel? So I went over and so it was me and Ornette and Charnette and DiNardo. And we were just playing music and we played for like an hour or two. And Ornette kept saying, it's so great. You're playing just what you're singing just what we're playing, And I thought it was funny because I was totally doing my own thing, And it's like I was, studying a lot of Wagner. So like I was improvising kind of riffs on these like kind of Wagnerian lines that I was thinking about. And I mean, of course, I was improvising with the other musicians, but it was, he kept saying like, you're singing just what we're playing.
Well, he was very adamant about people playing themselves.
Yeah.
And there was a funny, comment that somebody made at the memorial, which you'll probably appreciate. He said to everybody, you know, play like you are or play like you feel. And
yeah.
He stopped. He was working with this group, and he stopped them at one point and said, play like you feel. And the guy goes, and he pointed to one guy and goes, but you're not playing what you feel. he could tell if somebody was authentically expressing themselves or not.
Right.
This was a huge thing for him, and I guess you were hitting it. So this was a public performance.
Wait. So So we performed at the Barbican in London, and
so it was a quartet. It was you, Ornette, Donardo, and Charnette.
Yes.
Wow, that's a small group.
I was not the only extra musician in that concert. There was also a Persian singer, I think, and there was also another instrumentalist, and I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure there's a record of it somewhere, and I think there was a recording of it, and Ornette kept saying, oh, I want to give it to you, and I don't think I ever got a copy of it, because he recorded everything. He recorded all of his practice sessions and all of the concerts, so I'm sure there's a recording of it out there. But we wrote the music, actually. There were a few pieces that Ornette and I sat down. He was like, let's write some songs for the concert. So he and I sat down and wrote two or three songs to play on this concert. And it was just like, you know, melody lines that we were going to play. And we kind of played them in unison at the beginning. And then we went off and we, improvised. And it was like a whole long thing. And then we came back and played the melody again. And I think we had two or three of those songs for this concert.
Wow.
And,
go ahead.
No, it was just, I mean, it was great. It was great to sit down with him and like, write the music together, you know. It was fun.
Yeah, I'd say. But the process itself started in New York at the 125th Street Studio. Is that where you started first working together?
I think so. I can't remember if I went to his apartment first or if I went to 125th Street first, but those were, like, at least two or three different sessions where, you know, we were sitting down, we were like playing through some things together, we were writing some music, we were jamming together. I mean, the thing at 125th Street definitely was like jamming together, and it was like several hours long. And I remember at the time, like, I got tired. It was like 1 a.m. or something, and I was like, I can't sing any much more than this, so I'm gonna go home now. And he's like, really? Okay, we're gonna keep playing. Like, they were just playing and playing. But for singers, it's like, you know, you only have a limited amount of voice. You can't just like play and play and play for more than a few hours.
There's an oud player who I wish I could remember his name, and he has an album. It's a very good album. And there was a track on it called Ornette Never Sleeps. and I remember seeing that going, oh, that's interesting. And a lot of musicians that have worked with him, one of the things we posted recently was a reminisce from Pat Metheny.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the same. He said, yeah, he said, everybody thinks that I'm a workaholic musician. He said that he'd never in his entire career seen anybody that worked as hard and consistently at music as Ornette, that he just kept going and going and going.
Well, I think it seemed to me that he was just so, like, he just loved it so much. He, like, really lived music, you know. It's like, that was his whole, he was so passionate about it. He was so excited about it. Like, he just wanted to be making music and making art all the time. And I remember he really encouraged me, too. He's like, you need to be doing your own music, you know, because I'm kind of classically trained, and I love the classical repertoire. And, after that, I did have my own band, and I wrote some. But it's really, like, that is a total path of its own. And, he definitely had, like, so much music inside of him that he had to get out. And he was so unique, you know, just like such an individual and such a great creative spirit. Like, he really had so much expression, so much to share with the world.
And as you pointed out, he was always encouraging other people in their own creative expression. I mean, that was just a huge theme in his life.
Totally.
The other thing is really sort of interesting is, you know, he'd work with, quote, anybody. And by that I mean is he didn't, you know, a lot of musicians fall into a routine, and there's a small circle of people that they'll work with, or a type musician they'll work with. He just didn't think that way. And when he was, you know, he was world famous since 1959. But, you know, here's this guy that's super accomplished, super well known. And hey, if you were doing something interesting, he would meet you right where you were. And
Thing. Totally. Like, I was this young singer with, like, not all that much experience, but obviously, like, we had this kind of musical rapport. It was like, okay, we both love music. We both know how to speak this language. And like, let's make some music together, you know? And I think that's, it's such a great hallmark of a great artist. It's just like, this is the world we live in. Like, I want to share it with whoever is like my people. And I think like he saw that in me and I saw that in him. And we got the chance to work together, which was really great. And actually, When he died, I put something on Facebook that was like, oh, God, I had the great fortune to work with Ornette, and I'm so sad that he's gone. And another colleague of mine who's a really great bass player, John Feeney, he plays a lot of, like, Baroque basso continuo. So he plays with the Orchestra of St. Luke's. He posted something in response to what I had posted that he had gone to meet with Ornette and that he had, you know, gone through some music with him, and like Ornette was looking for a bassist and, you know, was really considering hiring John, even though he comes from this classical world. But it, again, it's like, these are two great musicians, and like they saw that in each other and they knew that like, okay, you speak my language. Like, even if you're from a different kind of part of the music world, like I can see that you are an artist, and like, you know, and it turned out that John didn't end up working with him, but like he said he had an amazing time just being with him, you know, all day this day and making music with him. So, I mean, that's the amazing thing about music. It's like, it's really a universal kind of language, and the people who speak it, it's like, it doesn't matter where you come from, where you're born. It's like we know each other when we see each other.
He had a plan to do a big orchestral piece called The Oldest Language, and the idea was he was going to have, I think, two musicians from every state in the union, and then a musician from every country in the world.
Wow.
that was what he wanted to put together. He sometimes used the phrase the caste system for sound, and he was very against it. You know, he was very against the idea of okay, you know, classical musicians over here, jazz musicians over here, rock musicians over here. Just he couldn't abide by that. He couldn't see it. He couldn't understand it. I wonder if you can remember. And it's a while back now, but I wonder if you can remember just, you know, some of the details of the working sessions, like. You know, you already mentioned that one went all the way till 1 a.m, and he was still ready to keep playing, and he was like, okay.
Oh, they did keep playing. I think they were going to keep rehearsing, and I was like, I'm sorry, I have to go to bed, you know. And so I left, and they were going to keep rehearsing.
Wow, and and again, it's a long time ago, but do you happen to recall, you know, roughly when that session might have started? Did it start in the afternoon? Did it start?
I don't totally remember, but I have a feeling like they would work all day and into the night, and we stopped, ordered some food, and then it was like, you know, had dinner and kept working. And I think that was, they were getting ready for the tour maybe, or, you know, it was just going to London and doing this one concert, so maybe it wasn't a tour, but he definitely was. And he was in charge, and he wanted to keep working. And I think Charnette and DiNardo were happy to keep at it with him, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember seeing him rehearse the Primetime Band in the Bowery Loft. And at that time, this was 1980 in the fall, and they didn't have any gigs. He was sort of not doing anything public at that time. And they were rehearsing. That was an all-day rehearsal. And I think the same thing happened to me. I think at some point I said, okay. I was just watching. And at some point I said, oh, my God, I got to get home. You know, and they were just going, and that's what I saw, and maybe you can talk about this, is he would – this is a band he'd worked with a lot. Now, he'd been working with them for at least 5 years, maybe longer, so they had a very deep rapport. But basically, they just played and just went on and played some more and played some more. And then, yeah, there was a break for food, obviously. And then they went back to it. And, yeah, you're right, he recorded everything. Did he have instructions? Were there things that he said that you know, guided the rehearsal? We're trying to recreate something, you know, that was years ago, but
I don't think so. I think what it seemed like what he did is got musicians that he liked, and like he liked what they did, and he brought them together. And it seems like then I don't remember him giving a lot of instruction. Maybe there was like structure to a certain, you know, to a certain piece, like, you know, the pieces that we played, okay, we're going to play our melody together first, and then we're just going to go off and do our own thing.
That's kind of what I remember. Verbal discussion or instruction or guidance was, I can't remember any. Like, I just start playing. which is, you know, I think that, would you say that's different than the typical, quote, rehearsal in the music world? I mean, usually...
Oh, yeah, way different.
Yeah, for people that maybe have never witnessed a rehearsal or been a musician and been in a quote, normal rehearsal session, maybe you could just, you know, just describe a little bit of what that's like.
I guess it depends on what genre you're talking about. But, I mean, like, usually when there's a band leader or a conductor or someone who's, like, in charge, they're definitely going to give instructions. They're like, okay, can you do this a little softer? Can you do this a little louder? In this part, we need to be more together in this part. You know, it's like there are tons of instructions that a leader can give. It seemed to me that Ornette, like, what he really loved to do was play, which, I mean, I totally understand. I think a lot of musicians are like this. They want to just play. They just want to be in the music. They want to be making the music all the time without a lot of rules or structure or parameters or something. I mean, and I think that's what his idea about harmelotics was. It's like, it's always about going on to what's next. It's like you're in the music and it's going to take you to the next place and then take you to the place after that. And it's a very kind of free feeling instead of feeling kind of like hemmed in by what you should be doing or trying to follow like a certain guidelines or something.
And yet there is some structure, right? There's some. I mean, is it based on the melody on the original tune?
Yeah, I mean that's the stuff that I did with him. Yes, there was like a melody to each song, but the melody never resolved. It was always like a melody that went from one place to another, basically.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, I wish I had a recording of the pieces that we did so we could have an example of that. But I'm sure that, you know, there are many examples of harmelotics out there.
Yeah, just about any tune that Ornette wrote and certainly performed. Yeah, there is the music just takes flight and it's like a free bird going wherever it feels like going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ornette, I know from his history that he didn't see an orchestral performance until he was 30.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he'd heard some classical music and orchestral music in his music appreciation classes in school. But, you know, that was until that point in his life. That was his exposure. Did you happen to talk with him about, I mean, was he interested in your experience with Wagner and that kind of thing? Did that ever come up? Just curious.
I don't think so. I mean, I think, I don't think we talked about that too much. I mean, basically there's, you know, the instruments are kind of similar. It's like, okay, there are a few saxophones there are a few orchestral pieces that involve saxophones, but, like, you know, the bass is, like, that's an instrument in an orchestra. There's percussion. it's the same. It's basically all Western music, you know, even if it's the style is different. And the same thing with the vocalism. It's, like, operatic singing is often, and a woman's voice is often, like, at a higher pitch, but, like, and the timbre of the voice is, like, different than it would be if you're singing jazz, but... I don't know. I feel like to a musician, it's not all that different.
Mm-hmm.
You're still making music. It's still like the basic instrument making a certain kind of music, you know, even if the styles differ.
Mm-hmm. So you had lunch. He said, let's make some music. You probably went over to his place in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Did some musical experimentation there.
Mm-hmm.
Then ended up at 125th Street. And I guess at some point he said, "Hey, come." What point did he say, "Come to London and perform with us at the Barbican"? I mean, did that shock you or surprise you? I mean, that's kind of a big leap, or maybe not. Maybe it just seemed like a natural progression based on how
I think it did seem kind of natural. I mean, it's hard to totally convey it. I mean, Ornette was pretty far out. Like, I can't kind of convey the uniqueness of how he would talk. It's like he had his own way of talking, his own kind of like progression. It was not logical in the way that we think of it. It's like he just, I don't know, it's like he marched to his own drummer and like, so yeah, I was not surprised when he said that because I was like, I think I was imagining it. I knew that he was going to do this performance, and I was like, oh, I would love to be involved in that performance. And then we started, you know, like hanging out and collaborating some over the period of some weeks. So it seemed like it was kind of like a natural progression. But maybe to other people who weren't as understanding of where he was coming from or something, I don't know. He was pretty far out, but I totally got where he was coming from all, you know, most of the time. So I don't know. It's hard to explain completely.
I see what you mean. Yeah, if the very fact that you could go with it, because, Ornette, definitely a conversation. Sometimes the conversations were absolutely normal, regular.
Uh-huh.
And, talk about the weather, talk about recollections of different places he'd been. Pretty straightforward. But, sometimes he would click into another mode, and you really had to listen to what he was saying, because it was not superficial conversation.
Yeah, it was, like, really deep, but really, like, but I totally got it, and it's like we were kind of on the same wavelength. It was like when I was singing and I was just doing my own thing totally, and like improvising, and he would say like, "You're doing exactly what we're doing," and it's like, whoa, that's so cool that we could all be doing exactly what is, you know, our own creative expression, and it's like all melding into this one united thing.
Yeah. His speech, sometimes it was sort of oracle-like. In other words, you couldn't really pin down at least sometimes for me, I couldn't really pin down exactly what his meaning was, but it forced you to sort of really listen and try to understand. I had this experience. I don't know if you've had it, but I wonder if other people have had it. But he would say something, and I go, "That's just the craziest thing I ever heard." I mean, I would just think that to myself. and then a year later, 5 years later, or 20 years later, I would think about it and go, "Oh my God, he was completely right."
Wow, that's cool.
He was totally right about that. Now I understand it. Maybe not every musician and musically trained person in the world would be able to, have that kind of rapport with Ornette and just, follow where he was going and be in that same space. So, I can see it, why he would say, "Oh, well, I can work with this person. Let's do a project together." And again, he was very big on, he's kind of like that, "Hey, let's do it." What's that thing with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland? "Hey, kids, let's put on a show." He never lost that youthful, childlike wonder about the power of getting together with friends and doing a show, which you have to admit, a lot of people that attain prominence in any field, not just music, but any field, things start to get calcified and there start to become barriers between them and the rest of the profession. And Ornette just did not play that game. It just never occurred to him.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think with a lot of musicians, they get kind of hierarchical, or elitist or something like that. And yeah, I didn't get that from him at all. That he had, it was more, I mean, and I also often say this about any kind of musician, like there's often a lot of ego. So it's like with musicians, it seems like, and maybe all artists, it's like either they're for the music or for the art, for the artistic expression, or they're for themselves. And Ornette was definitely one of those people who was completely dedicated to the art and the artistic expression, nothing else was going to really matter to him.
So going back to this narrative, rehearsals in New York, and then, "Hey, why don't you come to London with us and perform?" What do you recall about the overall show? So you said that it was at the Barbican?
Yeah, so it was at the Barbican in London, and Ornette, Charnette, DiNardo, and they had a trio, so they did part of the concert, I think just the three of them. There was part of the concert that I think was a Persian singer, and then there was another kind of instrumentalist. I don't know, it was either like somebody who played a Chinese instrument or something. I can't remember. I wasn't in that piece. We might have done a piece all together, but I can't remember. And then I did like two or three songs with the trio. I think Ornette played saxophone and trumpet and even maybe violin at this concert. Like he was pulling out all the stops because he hadn't played in London in a really long time, and the concert was sold out and it was really well received. It seemed like it was a lot of his long-term fans, and like they really were just like eating up whatever he had to give them, you know.
Well, I briefly, when the internet was new, I was running Ornette's website and collecting email addresses from visitors, and usually this is really the primitive times, and basically would say, hey, email us, and we'll, you know, we didn't have forms even, you know how now you put your name and your email address, and purchase it. That didn't even exist. So people would write us, and then we hand paste the name into the list and so on. And therefore, there were a lot of personal letters coming in, personal notes. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing all over the world. I remember an architect from Finland and just going on and on about how the concert that he'd seen in 1965 completely changed his life and changed his thinking. And, yeah, so, yeah, who knows how many people he touched deeply, but it sounds like he had a good audience of his fans waiting for him. Was it just one show? Was it just one performance? Or were there a couple of them?
No, I think it was just one,
Wow. And was it part of anything? Was it part of a series, or it's always, if he was, his performances were always mysterious, and I would always often find out about them after the fact. I remember one time he played with the New York City College jazz band, and I remember finding out about it 3 days later. I'm like, oh, I wish I'd known about that. In other words, there wasn't a fixed promotional machine that was, you know, he wasn't on, he very rarely was on a tour. I mean, I guess he did have tours, but there were a lot of one-offs. Like, it sounds like this was a one-off. It wasn't, you guys weren't traveling the world. It wasn't like this big thing. It was a big thing, but it was, he met some people. He liked what they were doing. Somebody said, here's some money, come to London. He said, okay, I'm bringing these people with me. Wow, so there was a Persian singer, and then was the guy playing sort of like a fiddle, but
Yeah, of course. I don't remember. I mean, I might have the program somewhere, but like, I don't really remember what was going on, because I don't think I played with that musician, but it was definitely like a very interesting event. And I mean, you know, important in my development too, because it was a pretty high profile venue and like just a very interesting musical experience. I mean, at the time it felt very normal, or it felt like, of course, this is what's happening right now, you know, which sometimes these like very important and interesting events, they feel like that in the moment. They feel like really amazing and really great, but I didn't have any moment of like, I can't believe I'm doing this. It seemed like, of course I'm doing this.
Right. And again, you were 24 at the time?
I think so, yeah.
And this would have been was this around 2000?
Yeah, I think it was 2000, 2001, something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, one of the things we're doing in this series is placing, you know, I have some interviews with and some recollections of actually when Ornette was in New Orleans in the 40s, which was an amazing time, and L.A. stuff, and then, you know, New York in the 80s, New York in the 90s, you know, the 2000s. So this was part of that phase, or that part of his, I mean, I guess his life, in a sense, was a harmonic performance. There was no, okay, now I've reached the mountaintop and I'm done. You know, he just kept going and going.
Right. But there was not a lot of, like, rehashing the old. I mean, I guess, you know, he always was, there was always improvisation, you know, that was a constant. But, of course, it's really always new. It's like every single performance is new and unique.
What was a surprise to me when I met him was he had somebody, I don't think it was his, somebody had like a children's portable record player. I think this was just the era, I don't think there were CDs then. And that's what was in his loft on the Bowery, and he didn't have any records. He was just completely, which just stunned me. And I'm like, oh my, I thought he was having amazing, he had art, he had a lot of art, visual art. But no records. It was just, you know, his music and playing and rehearsing prime time. Well, great. Anything else that comes to mind before we wrap this up? You said it had a big impact. Obviously, career-wise, it's great. You know, you can perform with Ornette Coleman.
I don't know that it necessarily. I guess it's always hard to say like how one thing leads to another. Sometimes it's very easy. It's like, oh yes, I met this person and he introduced me to this other person. But with Ornette, I mean, because I'm primarily a classical singer, like I don't know that it like propelled my career to any other level, but I mean, it's just, I feel like all of my experiences in my musical life have been formative in one way or another. And it's just always a joy to work with somebody who's really dedicated to a life of music, creativity, art, and who really respects those of us who are doing the same thing. So, I mean, mm-hmm. so definitely working with Ornette was one of those experiences where he was very, very respectful, very professional, and, you know, living in this other plane, in the plane of music and art. And, yeah, it's like he was definitely a kindred soul. Like, and it's always a joy to meet somebody else who's living that, like, really inspired life.
Great. Sylvia, if people want to follow your career and see what you're up to, what's the best way for people to do that?
Well, I have a website. It's www.sylviejensen.com.
So it's S-I-L-V-I-E.
Yeah, J-E-N-S-E-N.
S-E-N.com.
Mm-hmm. And, I'm mostly living in San Francisco and performing in the Bay Area, but I do still, you know, perform in New York and internationally. So
great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for spending the time with us and sharing your recollections. It's another part of the Ornette Coleman puzzle, which maybe isn't a puzzle at all. Maybe he's just, as you've described so clearly, a guy that just absolutely loved music without limits, and that took him to all the places that he ended up. Maybe there's no puzzle here at all.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Sylvia, and I will let you know when this is posted and where you can listen to it and see all the other stuff we've collected so far.
Cool. That's so great. Thanks, Ken.
Okay.
All right. Take care.